This podcast is brought to you by the Albany Public Library Main Branch and the generosity of listeners like you.
What is a podcast?
God, Daddy, these people talk as much as you do. Razib Khan's Unsupervised Learning.
Thanks for listening to the ungated version of the Unsupervised Learning podcast. If you want to read some essays on some of these topics, please check out razib.substack.com. Again, that's razib.substack.com. Thank you.
10% of pediatric cancer is linked to a single gene variation. These variants can be detected in embryos before pregnancy begins. ORCID's whole genome reports can help mitigate your child's risk for cancer by screening for 90-plus genetic variants linked to pediatric cancer. Discuss embryo screening and IVF with a genetics expert.
Hey, everybody. This is Razib Khan with the Unsupervised Learning Podcast. And today I have a returning guest, Dr. J.P. Mallory. And we are here to talk about the origin of the Indo-Europeans. Just a quick reminder, Dr. Mallory is a retired professor at Queen's University, Belfast. And he was the editor of Journal of Indo-European Studies, member of the Royal Irish Academy. And he's written many books. But the one that I kind of want to talk about as a starting off point for this discussion today is In Search of the Indo-Europeans, Language, Archaeology, and Myth, which was published in 1989. And I want to talk about it in the context of the new paper that just came out of David Reich's lab, first authored by Yosef Lazaridis. And it's called The Genetic Origin of the Indo-Europeans, which I think makes sense why I want to discuss the book in the context of this paper, which is, so I guess it's like 35 years after the book. So it's been a while. I'm assuming you've had like a chance to look at the paper a little bit, but I'm going to review it just for the listeners who haven't listened to my earlier podcast. Basically, they sampled new populations in a region, the lower Volga, drainage basin down into the Caucasus, but really the lower Volga. They found a new population there, and that population is the dominant contributor to the later Yamnaya. An interesting twist here is it looks like the Hittites, along with the Luvians and probably Peleans, the Anatolian language family populations, have a gene flow from this lower Volga population. It's on something called the Caucasus Lower Volga Kline. They just created that name to talk about the distribution of ancestry there, which is, you know, a mix of Eastern hunter-gatherer, Caucasus, Neolithic, some Central Asian, all over the place. Gets more complicated the further back in time you go. And so they posit that the Proto-Indo-Europeans descend from the Yamnaya, who went west, mixed with a minority population of hunter-gatherers, foragers of the Dnieper, whereas the Anatolians went south through the Caucasus and, are the earliest diverged population. So clearly supports the Indo-Anatolian hypothesis, where the Anatolians are the outgroup and the Proto-Indo-Europeans are their sister group. So I think that's the nutshell. There's a lot more in the paper. There's been a lot more that we've learned, I think, obviously, in the 35 years. So, Dr. Mallory, I'm just kind of curious, how do you feel about your book after all this time?
Out of date. It's still out of date for a wide variety of reasons, but it is at least in terms of its main conclusions, it's pretty well holding up, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so, you know, in the context of the last, let's just say generation, what we've seen since 2015, around 2015 with the emergence of ancient DNA is the Pontic Steppe hypothesis basically in some form seems to have been vindicated. All the other, you know, kind of new and fashionable competitors, whether it's from the Caucasus or Anatolia, seem to have been pushed by the wayside by the genetic data.
To some extent, that would be a quick reading. I was taking another glance at the article actually just before we went on the air, at at the fact that what this paper does, it's very much concerned with the origins of the Yamnaya culture, the genetic signature that emerges in the Yamnaya culture. And it throws it back towards the Serenistique culture as, shall we say, you know, an earlier ancestor. However, when it comes to the major problem that we face, if you're an Indo-European homeland hunter, that problem is still out there, and it has not been resolved. And I'll try to explain what I mean. I'm going to try to put a wider context on this whole thing. It is very easy to sit there and say, well, what have the geneticists finally solved the Indo-European homeland problem? I mean, after all, it's been on the books since 1786, since Sir William Jones gave his third anniversary discourse and said that he was going to devote some of his lectures to looking for the origin of what we today would call the Indo-European language family. And I suspect because of the way that we consume information regarding the hunt for the Indo-European homeland, we're very much guided by, you know, the access that is provided by major scientific journals and so forth. And I suspect that we often forget that there's a reason why the Indo-European homeland has not been resolved for 238 years. And that's because that there are at least three stakeholder disciplines involved in the question. Linguists, archaeologists, and now, having replaced physical anthropologists, we have geneticists. So we have archaeogenetics or paleogenomics. And we have a problem that none of these on their own can solve the Indo-European homeland problem. On the other hand, each one of them largely believes it has a veto on a solution created by any of the other stakeholders. And to make matters even more complicated, each of those stakeholders do not represent a single entity, but represent a variety of competing different theories themselves. So when we get solutions that we're discussing, you know, right now, because this is frequently a genetics podcast, we're looking at it from a viewpoint of the genetic evidence. And what we can often miss is that, you know, a year ago or so, on basically linguistic evidence, a different homeland solution was being proposed and feted in the scientific journals. And so these things are always going to be, you know, in competition with one another. And the constituencies have a very, very difficult time convincing another constituency that it's wrong. And so this is sort of what we've come to. Now, in terms of the steplands, and because you made the contrast there between the step theory, which has certainly been around since the late 19th century with the works of Otto Schrader. And it has always been there as at least part of an element of a solution. And what we've come to with this new, should we say, genetic revolution is that the stepland is either, in almost anybody's theory, either the Indo-European homeland, part of the Indo-European homeland, because there are still theories floating around that indicate that suggest that the Indo-European homeland extends all the way from, shall we say, Northern Europe or Baltic Europe to the steppelands, or it is a secondary homeland, and that is that the homeland, the real homeland, is elsewhere, and a population moved into the steppe and are responsible for the spread of some, but not every Indo-European language. And what we're battling with here from the genetic standpoint is that the steppe land, no matter how you play it, is going to involve a genetic admixture of two major ancient ancestries, Eastern hunter-gatherer and Caucasian hunter-gatherer, with a, shall we say, a top-up of Anatolian farmer and maybe a little bit also of West Siberian hunter-gatherer. And from a non-genetic standpoint, when you're confronted with two of these ancient components having to come together to explain your steppe homeland, it naturally raises the question, well, which of those two ancient components was the vector, the real vector for the ancestral language that led to, evolved into Indo-European? Was it native to the steppe lands, Eastern hunter-gatherers, or was it actually native to the Caucasus region or south of the Caucasus, to CHG? And talking about the recent paper, the battle has been, how do these two come together? And what's the root? And can it tell us anything about which one of these is actually the vector for the Indo-European language family? And the paper, as you've indicated there, it is basically arguing that the CHG that we're finding, at least the predominant element that comes from CHG, is what they have identified as Ignatian-like, and that is, it is similar to the type of CHG that is found among the earliest farming communities of the Kura-Araxes region, which then later appears in Maikop and then north of it. Now, let's remember, we're looking at a paper fronted by Josef Lazaridis. And remember that just a few years ago, he was the first name on the paper on the Southern Arc, in which it came to the conclusion that the Indo-European homeland was most likely south of the Caucasus and not on the steppe. One of the first questions that you would come to mind, well, what has changed regarding this?
Sure.
What made it different? And it seems to me, and it is absolutely admitted in their paper, that they're talking about the genetic origin primarily of the Yamnaya people, but that they say that still they are incapable of coming down one way or the other as to which was the element that were actually the ancestral element that brought the evolution of Indo-European into being.
Yeah.
One could still argue for a South Caucasian homeland if you want to assume that Indo-European came via the Caucasus, via the people who introduced livestock keeping north of the Black Sea to the steppe populations in the lower Volga region and the lower Don region and so forth. So, from a viewpoint of the homeland problem, the fat lady still hasn't sung. It's not really over. We still, the debate is still there. Now, in terms of, best guess, from my point of view, I would lean towards the idea that the Indo-European, and this is from a linguistic point of view, homeland is still north of the Black Sea. And the reason for that moves away from the admixture, but more to the haplogroups. And it is just simply the incredible paucity, lack, except for, the odd ones. For example, there's a Serenistique burial that is carried what we'll call a southern male haplogroup, Y haplogroup. But you know, if the model is farmers, superior farmers, bearing CHG, or early Bronze Age elites from the Maykop culture, bearing a more sophisticated social organization along with metallurgy and the a new economy, spread their language north of the Caucasus, I would have thought we would have been seeing a lot more evidence for the male haplogroups. And consequently, what it looks like, so far as we can see, is really, it happens elsewhere in this world of Indo-European genetics, where we've got an incredible number of missing males that have disappeared. And that becomes one of the great problems, where, you know, the sisters are intermarrying with populations from the steppe, but we don't find what happened to the brothers.
Yeah.
And this is what we find also on the western fringe of Europe. If we deal with the Beakers, for example, it sets up a genetic scenario, which is archaeologically a nightmare to try to explain. You know, what happened to the local males in this case, with the spread of so-called steppe genetic signature. So, in a nutshell, I would have still, I would still go with what I wrote back in 1980. God, I can't remember 89. For those reasons, but I am well aware that anybody with an ounce of cleverness can keep a Caucasian or a South Caucasian homeland still alive. And indeed, you could even, to some extent, keep an Anatolian farmer one still alive. Because when you're talking about the genetic signature of CHG coming from this population in, you know, Armenia and Georgia, this population with the early farming communities is very heavily also Anatolian farmer. It's not in any way, what shape or form, pure CHG.
Yeah.
So you could have language shift involved between early farmers. So I'm afraid the ultimate solution to the Indo-European homeland problem is still a little beyond the horizon.
Well, you know, I mean, I guess that's good for Thomas Olander and his colleagues. You know, there's still younger scholars involved in this field, and they have some research to do, so that's good. You know, I want to like just back up and unpack a little bit of what you said about the paternal haplogroups. You know, I think the key issue that you're pointing to is there are some paternal haplogroups, Y chromosomal lineages, usually branches of J, J1, J2, G, G2, that are found in the southern regions that you're alluding to. They're not that common among the Yamnaya and their successor populations, you know, to the west in particular, say the Corded Ware. What you do find is R1A, R1B, sometimes Q. These are all ultimately, really, if you go back far enough, they look to be probably Paleo-Siberian, ancestral North Eurasian. The Malta boy who was in East Central Siberia, I think by Lake Baikal, he was a basal branch of R, like R star, I believe. And R and Q are brother haplogroups. And, you know, I haven't like followed up on this in a long time, but these Y chromosome lineages, they have a very, very weird patterns when you really look at tens of thousands of years of where they've traversed. Like the ancestral basal lineages actually come from East Asia for R and Q, and I could have been like, you know, some male during the Pleistocene, you know, 35,000 years ago, mixes with the ancestral North Eurasians and it spreads and becomes dominant there. And now, you know, we're talking about a situation where in Western Europe, 75% of the males are a branch of R1B, and R is originally possibly East Asian if you go back 40,000 years ago. Obviously, Western Europeans are not East Asian. The Y chromosome lineage has decoupled, you know, from the overall ancestry. Okay, so that happens. I think the second issue maybe is in the background of what you were alluding to is all of the evidence that we have indicates Indo-European societies were patrilineal. So if Indo-European societies are patrilineal, earlier Indo-European societies are patrilineal, Y chromosome haplogroups seem like they would be an important thing to look at, right? And so what you're seeing is the Y chromosome haplogroups tend to be from the Eastern hunter-gatherers. Okay, well, from that, it possibly follows that the Eastern hunter-gatherers are the ones that spoke the pre-Indo-European or whatever you want to see it, say it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, we are in this situation where there's cultural dynamics that are happening that are partly coupled with probable genetic dynamics, but we don't have so Hittite is like the oldest written Indo-Europe or Indo, if you want to say Indo-Anatolian language, right? And so, you know, you're talking about archaeologists and linguists. You know, they obviously deal with material remains and linguists, I mean, languages. Well, without writing, I'm actually kind of curious because I don't know. I mean, I know you're an archaeologist by training, but I mean, linguists have these phylogenetic models, but the reality is, unlike paleogenetics, they don't have ancient languages that they can put in their trees to resolve some of the phylogenies. I mean, where are we going to go with the linguistics after, you know, well over a century? It seems very implausible to me that there's going to be, I mean, it could be, there, but Hittite's probably as early as we're going to get. I mean, it's pretty early.
Yeah. Yeah, you're not, that's one of the problems is that it's genetics, which is continually expanding because it's having a database that is being expanding almost exponentially. However, where we are on this expansion is, in fact, I think I'll take the hint from what you were saying there. For anybody who has sat there and said, "Oh, pumped in a haplotype, where was it?" and you put it on a map, and it makes no sense whatsoever, or it makes too much sense. That is, you could make up God knows how many different scenarios to explain how it goes. And so we're basically drawing lines between dots, and we started with very, very few dots. And one of the things that scares me to some extent is that the number of dots we have for the Caucasus is really far, far too few. In terms of establishing, for example, what haplogroups really should we be associating with CHG? You know, you get two pre-Neolithic ones, in Serbia and the Mesolithic site, Kitaiskilda. And after that, everybody else you've got is already admixed with an Anatolian farmer. And so you can't separate out one from the other, and so you can't see the evolution of the Neolithic, and what is native and what is not native. That one is, you know, that is certainly troublesome. There is another issue since we're raising this, so that's the question between linguistics and genetics, is that the discourse regarding the genetics is very much a discourse regarding admixture percentages and things like this. But there is absolutely no way, certainly that I know of translating an admixture percentage into what I will call a linguistic probability. In other words, and the thing, you know, if you've got a population in Central Anatolia that is 90% Anatolian farmer and only 10% CHG, you've got a gut level feeling there. Now, the percentages that are given for Anatolian speakers in this new paper who have an origin somewhere in the steppe coming into Central Anatolia is 11%. I would have, you know, in the case of Anatolia, I just dismissed the 10%, but do I wind up accepting an 11%? And I'm fully aware that one of the problems with with genetic evidence to begin with, from an archaeological point of view, is that unless it is contextualized and can be contextualized archaeologically, the evidence can be misread horribly regarding what its potential effects on a given society might have been in terms of language shift or something like that.
Yeah,
we may never be able to tell. And I'm not quite aware of that, so I won't pretend that we can go through an entire cemetery and sit there and say, well, who's on top socially and who's on bottom? But mixing it with the genetic evidence, and if we're treating that as purely random, it becomes very difficult to imagine how we can further the discourse of discussing the genetic evidence in terms of linguistic probabilities, other than, you know, gross percentages.
Yeah, what you're alluding to here is, you know, and people who are in the genetic space who are moving into this know this is true. You know, people, you're engaging in ad hoc reasoning. So, you know, okay, in Sri Lanka, let's say you see 10% steppe ancestry. And you're like, oh, okay, well, that 10% is from the, you know, Indo-European speakers originally, and that's how Sinhala came about. And like, you just kind of know enough of the historical and cultural context to just make that conclusion. But when you strip away it in another context, you don't really, you know what to think. When David Anthony saw the original, you know, the 2015 paper, the proportion of Yamnaya ancestry was much higher than he was expecting. Like, his expectation was it was more of an elite diffusion. He was probably expecting closer to 10%. He got 75%. So you have this huge range that you see across populations. And I think part of this is genetics, you know, obviously is flexible, but culture is extremely flexible. And so the variation of culture when it corresponds to genetics is a difficulty. Now, you know, I think technically one way you could imagine trying to solve this is, you know, creating a vast database of correspondences, having some sort of, like, you know, machine learning or deep learning, and then try to say, okay, well, here is our, you know, estimate and probability. But, you know, the problem here is how do we have a ground truth of a lot of these things? You know, are we just going to rely on the black box and the machine? And this is just a problem that I've had with deep learning inferences where, you know, if it's not clear that it's right, you just kind of trust the algorithm. And I don't think we're ever going to do that for this question.
Yeah, well, I was contemplating, you know, on the history of this whole problem, once modern genetics began to be applied, so we're talking about pre-ancient DNA, but this flurry of activity that occurred, should we say, about the time of Cavalli-Sforza and his development. You did have things like, I remember, in fact, I've still got it in my database, Robert Sokol gathering together data of every invasion ever recorded in human history, if possible, to study the, you know, potentially study these things from genetic points of view and so forth, and language. And what we are missing to some extent is looking at societies for which we actually have historical records well enough that we can actually ground-proof the genetic evidence and actually feel a bit more comfortable about whether we can draw inferences or not from the evidence. Because we may find we can't draw it.
Not with levels of, you know, statistical confidence or whatever. You know, one thing I was saying is, like, you know, many years ago, you know, the field of phylogenetics itself for a long time was, you know, kind of based on intuition, you know, whatever, like, you know, people would draw trees, you know, based on what they, you know, knew in an ad hoc fashion. And, you know, I remember an older phylogeneticist telling me before, you know, cladistics is kind of not used too much actually in a lot of fields anymore, but cladistics, which is a kind of a systematic way to evaluate relationships, was a revolution initially because it replaced the tendency of two scholars to just argue and assert from their own authority and intuition. And that's really what we need on a lot of these questions. And, you know, I think part of the problem that you've actually just implicitly identified is, it's strewed across three vast disciplines. And so bringing these people together to produce a paper, first of all, I know is difficult in the first place, but to kind of create a synthetic field, which is what you're alluding to, what probably is part of the solution, that is a massive undertaking that probably is going to require more money than even the Templeton Foundation has, which, you know, Templeton Foundation's backing a lot of this work out of the Reich Lab in particular, I know. And so, you know, you need resources. And are people interested in this question? Now, I will acknowledge here, it's like, I think people are quite interested in this particular question, judging by the social media engagement and, you know, just like I see the downloads. People are interested in what I will say is, like, from my Substack, people are as interested in the Indo-European question as they are in the genetic relationship of Jews and Palestinians. Like, that's at that level, okay? So they're very interested, you know? It's like, I mean, that's the truth. Like, those are the two highest traffic questions. So, you know, and, like, people are interested in very different cultures, too. So if you write a book about Indo-Europeans, like, you know, a lot of people in India will be interested. They might not be happy with the conclusion, but they'll be quite interested because it's Indo-European. So, you know, this covers half of the language, half of the people in the world or something speak these languages, right? So I think that the interest is there. Now, part of the issue is, you know, the interest is across so many different countries, getting the collaborations together. But I think what you're alluding to, what we're talking here is, like, we have a profusion of data from ancient DNA now that's triggered, like, a newfound, like, broader interest. We need to, like, bring people together and have a more systematic framework to understand some of these questions if we're going to make progress, as opposed to just arguing online, which is what's happening.
Yeah. No argument there.
Yeah. in terms of, I guess in terms of what the recent work in the last 3 years has shown, I want to, like, talk to you. I don't recall in our previous conversation. So the Tocharians, it looks like genetically, you know, they are an early branch of the Yamnaya. But the Tarim Basin mummies from 1800 turn out not to have the classical Indo-European signature. I was wondering if you had some updated thoughts on Tocharians, because I know that's one of the topics of interest for you.
Yeah, I don't have any updated thing. I'll make two or three comments regarding that. First, the DNA. The model, and I think it still holds together, the Afanasyevo culture, this being genetically indistinguishable from Yamnaya, that's found in the Altai and in the Minnesota Basin, did spread south across the Altai into what we call, it's called the Jungar Basin, which is the basin immediately north of the Tian Shan Mountains. The Tocharians are south of the Tian Shan Mountains. And the genetic signature in this area of the Jungar Basin it still carries that was, you know, earlier seen in the Afanasyevo slightly. So you can get a population genetically similar to the Yamnaya within approximately 200 kilometers of areas of known Tocharian speakers, the centers of Tocharian. And this is what I'm going to emphasize. The mummies, they've been studied, but the mummies, by and large, are not located in areas in which anybody could put their hands on their heart and said that Tocharian was the language being spoken there. The earliest ones from Shao He, or the one from Beifang Mudi, these are areas well outside of Tocharian A and B manuscripts. This whole area, the so-called Shao He area culture, which gives us our earliest ones, this whole area, anywhere near Lop Nur, it only works regarding Tocharians if we envisions the existence of a Tocharian sea, which has been suggested occasionally. Mm. that there are Prakrit documents, etc., that have Tokarian-like names in them. But they are not the centers of the Tokarians. And we do not have, to the best of my knowledge, any decent DNA from near, and I would hone in on Kuchar as the main center, that particular area. And without that, we really can't talk much about what we'll call what a Tokarian would look like genetically. And indeed, given the fact that what we're dealing with are Buddhist monks, largely, who are practicing cremation,
It'll be hard. It'll be tough.
It's going to be good luck. We're going to have to intercept them before they become Buddhists.
Yeah.
Sometime during the Iron Age, perhaps. Certainly, or yeah, maybe the end of the Bronze Age, when they have come theoretically through the Tian Shan Mountains and begun settling in the oases. Until we've got that evidence, we can't really talk about Tokarian genetics.
Yeah, well, another option would be to get a really, really large number of whole genome sequences of Uyghurs and look deep. But for geopolitical reasons, that is not going to happen anytime soon. You know, so I think we're stuck there. I'm actually like a little surprised. Or I mean, I guess they had it a lot of the database, but, you know, with the war in Ukraine and stuff like that. You know, there's still stuff going on in the ancient DNA and the research there, but I'm assuming they had those samples ahead of time. I think like some of the stuff with the Caucasus in the Middle East, people always ask me. I mean, my understanding is just the politics, sometimes just like the danger in some of these areas. You know, like for example, like in Mesopotamia, imagine trying to be an archaeologist in Mesopotamia in the middle teens. You know, I think that's just you're not going to go there. Because there's ISIS running around and stuff like that. So some of the stuff that we're waiting on is just geopolitically constrained, you know? Other aspects are the climate. There's a reason that cold areas are getting so much ancient DNA. I know the privately people, I know, like they've told me privately, don't be so skeptical about the possibility of tropical DNA. So they're working on new methods, but, you know, that's I'm going to believe it when I see it, you know? So that'll probably like transform some things. And then you were alluding to the paper last year from Hegarty et al., I think, about Indo-European languages. And that had like a lot of, I'm going to say, weird results. And I know the method that they used, and that's a real method that's used all across biology, these phylogenetic methods. There's just arguments, I think, about the using the, you know, lexical structures, I think, that they use as input data, right? So, you know, there's some technical arguments that can be had about that. But, you know, the good thing about the Hegarty paper is we can actually have an argument about their methods in a very concrete way because they're very explicit about everything and how they set it up. And I think that's the important aspect to go forward. I was curious, you know, aside from like the specific results, as I said, the Indo-European question is actually super interesting to the broader public. Some of it for, you know, unsavory ideological reasons, but that's actually a very small minority in my experience, no matter like, you know, how much publicity that gets. Mostly people are just interested because a lot of, you know, regular people on the street actually don't know that languages in India are related to languages in Europe, you know, even some academics, you know, and when they find out, it's very, very perplexing, and they want to know why. I mean, this is like very simple, right? It's actually the issue that cropped up in the 18th century, you know, where it's like, why? So this is like a broadly interesting topic. I know in Europe, you know, like Thomas Olander and his group, you know, in Northern Europe, there are departments that are focused on this issue, you know, whereas in the United States, there really are not. And I was just wondering about what do you think the prospects are for the study of Indo-Europeans as like a coherent, like, you know, subject topic that brings a lot of scholars together. Because right now, you know, obviously, you know, Christian Christiansen, people like him, David Anthony, are still studying it. But, you know, it seems like there's no systematic study in the United States. And the United States is a big deal, like in terms of funding, the number of universities you have and all that.
Well, yeah, I came through one of the things that you were describing as a wish, because my PhD was in Indo-European studies at UCLA at a time in which, in order to get your PhD, you had to have a foot in three different fields. You had to qualify to some extent as a linguist, as an archaeologist, and the ability to deal with Indo-European comparative mythology. I think one of the problems, so it was a great interdisciplinary department, and it didn't leave you alone there, because you could take courses outside of that area as well. I did my archaeological theory and method with straight anthropology, American anthropology stream, as one normally would do. I think the key problem here is you can produce PhDs, but you can't find them jobs. And consequently, once you send these people out into the world, after a while, I think it's going to be seen how incredibly difficult it is to sustain, you know, that type of interdisciplinary department. UCLA still has the Department of Indo-European Studies. Okay. But it is not, shall we say, as expansive as it was in my time. And when I think the people who got PhDs along with me, almost invariably, they were teaching in departments that in no way resembled the one that they left and got their PhD in. When I think of many of the people, for example, who I have worked with as Indo-European linguists, they can very often find themselves teaching English or classics. And, you know, their Indo-European material, they might get a course in if they're really lucky, but that's it.
Well, why do you think it's different in Northern Europe? Because there are these still scholars that are deeply, like, you know, like Olander and, you know, some of these other guys.
But you've got centers, I would say. But, you are quite right that I can't speak on first-hand basis with the current state of what we'll call Indo-European linguistics across the United States. But you do have major centers. Certainly Leiden and Copenhagen are major centers for Indo-European studies. But you've got absolutely, you know, good Indo-Europeanists all over the place in Europe as well. I could argue that you've got them as well in America, but they're going to probably be isolated in their own departments.
Yeah, so there's not a community in the same way.
You're not going to have a number of people. I mean, in Leiden, Copenhagen, you can, well, particularly Leiden, would regularly have summer schools in linguists for people, you know, all across Europe to get a fortnight of Indo-European studies of some sort or another.
Yeah, yeah. Well, okay, so I want to just, like, last, like, topic before I let you go. I want to ask actually about something which I think I was going to ask about the first time we talked 3 years ago, but we ran out of time, and it's the Irish. So there have been some DNA works, you know, I think about Dan Bradley's lab about the Irish, and then there's more recent stuff, and that's come out also using ancient DNA in the whole British Isles, the whole, you know, United Kingdom plus Ireland, and variation during you know, Urnfield culture, post Urnfield culture, and stuff like that. So I guess the question that I have is, because I get this question and I don't know how to answer, because I don't know the Celtic languages. Okay, so people often ask me, is it the Bellbeakers or did it come later? Like, do you have, like, any update on your opinions on that sort of thing?
I will preface my explanation by referring back to the different stakeholders when I gave you that before. If you were purely a geneticist and you said to yourself, Where in the genetic history of Ireland do we see a marked change that would indicate a shift probably to an Indo-European language than it would be with the Beakers at about 2500 BC, when basically the Irish, certainly the male genome in Ireland, becomes, you know, R1B, and it becomes as the rest of the Beakers of Northern Europe. Now, that would satisfy a geneticist, I think. An archaeologist will go, ugh, because the archaeologist, before that evidence was released, I can't think of hardly an archaeologist in Ireland who would have ever regarded the Beakers as a major cultural transformation that would have completely seen the genetic replacement of the male lines, the existing male lines of Neolithic Ireland by incomers. It was an idea of the 1920s and 30s, but it had been completely dismissed. So from the archaeological, total shock, and is now having to deal with it by basically saying, but how in the world did this happen on the ground? How does replacement? Because we just do not see that type of evidence at all in terms of the archaeological record. Sure enough, Ireland becomes Beaker from head to toe, but it's extraordinarily difficult to understand how this came about. And from a linguistic point of view, generally, Celticists have felt far more comfortable having a Celtic language entering Ireland no earlier than about 1000 BC or later. And that is because the earliest Irish inscriptions are incredibly similar to those of ancient Gaul. The Irish inscriptions are from the 4th century to the 7th century, those from Gaul, you know, in the 1st century BC. If you sat there and said, oh yes, but they'd been separated by 2,500 years to 3,000 years, that is very difficult to swallow. Regarding, so once again, as I said, you have three different stakeholders, each with different, should we say, general views that are very difficult to reconcile with one another. And that's where we stand insofar as Irish origins are concerned right now. And so and this is always going to be a problem. People will normally assume, well, we can trace the expansion of the Indo-Europeans, and now we've got a genetic signal for it. But the problem is, which Indo-Europeans are we finding? Are we finding earlier ancestors who have become totally unknown because they just simply disappeared and were replaced by later ones? Or do we really have to seek the roots of the ones that we know of, like the Celts, etc., further back in time?
Yeah, you know, I've tried to look into this, and I really can't make heads or tails because I don't think there's any consensus. There's a lot of research in various different fields on this question, especially before the genetics came out. And so, you know, you have these like entrenched groups, and also they're all Celts. The Celts are not like a minor phenomenon; they're a Western Europe wide phenomenon. And the Bell Beakers are also a Western Europe-wide phenomenon. And so you have a lot of different places to account for, because there's obviously Celtic people. The Celts are, like, at least in terms of total square miles, the dominant population in Iberia during the time of the Roman. I mean, aside from Gaul and, you know, the British Isles, Ireland, you know, they're dominant there. The question is, like, you know, when did they arrive? We know that, you know, steppe genetic type populations show up and do a similar thing to a lower magnitude, but pretty high magnitude on the Y chromosome, like 80% replacement, you know, in Spain, 2300 BC, 2200. So know, it's very attractive to have these like parsimonious models. On the other hand, just because a model is parsimonious, it doesn't mean it's right. I mean, that's the fundamental issue, you know, like over the set of all models, the parsimonious ones are more going to be correct, but you don't know which model you picked, the one where the parsimony aligns with, you know, or not.
And what happens is that once you begin getting the initial, shall we say, step genetic signature, what follows becomes harder and harder to discern. Whether, and this is why you have that earlier Harvard paper claiming that there is evidence for later movements. And this is based, you know, on the slightly higher percentage of what we'll call Western hunter-gatherer, you know, signature, etc. And so those arguments become more subtle, perhaps. As some of the geneticists have said, once we really have shifted much more to IBD evidence, and we're talking about identity by descent, and we actually can relate these people, and so they're not, you know, genetically rather than generically, so we should say almost, then we might be able to start coming up with scenarios that can actually explain something one way or the other.
Yeah, and you know, over this conversation, we've been talking about, you know, a lot of things we don't know. I mean, part of it right now, you know, like just like count our blessings, is all the data that's coming in. Now, we don't have interpretive frameworks for all the data, like you just alluded to in Ireland. You know, we don't have like strong answers or conclusions we can give people, which is what they really want. They don't really care about the methods, you know, they care about the answers. But, you know, we do have a lot of methods now. There's IBD data. You know, I've said for like the last, you know, decade or so, it's also like the cultural evolution models need to be brought in, because that way you have like explicit models synthesizing with the DNA. You know, this is an issue of two different disciplines, you know, although they can kind of speak the same language. But in any case, I don't know why that hasn't happened. But I think that needs to happen. Right now, ancient DNA is a, you know, it's a data-enriched field. And so people just, like, grab the most easiest, closest explanation. And I think that's why you also see, because people routinely complain, why do they change their mind over the paper so much? And I'm just like, well, I mean, they don't have like a really strong, robust theoretical framework, you know? So they just like look for like the easiest solution to any given result. And that like leads to some jumping around, which that's okay, but sometimes it's a little helpful.
To comment on that, because I'd like to make a distinction between the modern genetics and what we'll call the physical anthropological evidence that was debated. That was almost invariably driven by confirmation bias. And the one thing I find among the geneticists, they are perfectly capable of going with the data. If the data shifts, they shift with it. I've dealt with the geneticists from most of the main schools that are, you know, dealing there, and by and large, I don't really see, you know, tremendous biases that would mean that they would feel the necessity to simply defend, you know, against all logic. No, I more than likely, if the evidence starts shifting a different direction, they wind up shifting with it, and you know that that at least is healthy. You feel like you're dealing with rational scientists.
It's a new field. It's a new field, and you know, and there hasn't been calcification, and you know, it's also a little bit of disciplinary imperialism. When you do disciplinary imperialism, you invade a field, you start breaking things, which is good and bad. You know,
they have
no investment in the current superstructure because it's not what they were raised with. It's not what they've, you know, spent their time thinking about. It's not what their mentors have a publication record on.
Yeah, so
just like come in and just try to figure stuff out. Now, if we keep doing this for another 20 or 30 years, like, let's talk. But I think, you know, at some point, we're going to hit diminishing returns on a lot of this paleogenetics. There's only, like, so many samples of corded ware. You know, once we get to 10,000, 20,000 corded wares, Genomes. I think we got it solved. There are some like deeper selection questions maybe people can ask.
But there are still incredible missing areas. And that's one of the problems. Like you could raise up, we could have all of those CH, all of those cornedwares, but unless you've got, you know, a population from maybe Belarusia or someplace like that between the steppe and CHG, we're never going to be able to make the link.
Right now people like try to do like interpolations, but the issue with interpolations is it's kind of a straight line, and a lot of times it's not. That's what you're alluding to. When you actually look at the empirical data, it's a little bit more complicated. I think in most cases it's a little bit more complicated and subtle, because when you look at the first papers about the Yamnaya, it was like, oh, it was the Yamnaya, and then later it was like, oh, well, there's a corded ware branch. And then there's, you know, possibly a catacomb culture branch now. And, you know, I think, I don't know when the preprint's coming out. Christian Christiansen like hinted very strongly, but, you know, there's going to be new work about the Balkans and, you know, probably the Greeks, where it looks like they're not part of the corded ware branch. Lazaridis also does not believe they're part of the corded ware branch. So I think it's important. I think it's interesting and important to like elucidate the structure of at least the genetics of these Indo-Europeans, because there are arguments that have not been resolved about the linguistic structure, whether it's like a rake-like configuration or whether, like, you know, Indo-Iranian is actually closer to Baltic Slavic or not. You know, that's still an argument. I think it's a minority position that it is. But if you can establish IBD, like strong IBD contact between Balto-Slavs and early Indo-Iranians, then I think like that will shift the field. Yeah. You already know it from the R1A branching, which, you know, I think the mutation that separates Indo-Iranian from the Balto-Slavic, let's just say European from Asian right now, is like, I think it's like 3,500 BC, right? Which is like around the time of the initial Yamnaya expansion. So, you know, you got to bring all these like disparate facts together, I think, to generally get you know, constellation of information and try to make an inference. Now, is this practical? Like, is this news you could use? No, but I can tell you people are super fascinated by it. And United States, you know, we are a multi-ethnic country. Our history is very, very recent. I think here we don't understand how deeply interested people in, say, I don't know, like Lithuania or Serbia and India can get in these issues. I mean, invariably the longest and most argumentative feedback that I get are from, like, you know, people who come from areas where, you know, people have been there for a long time, specific ethnicities are associated with the nation state. And so these sorts of arguments actually have a deep resonance for them in terms of how they view themselves. So they're going to get involved. Whereas with Americans, I think they just read it. They're like, cool. They move on. You know,
so it's
you know, because it's like, that was before 1800. Who cares? You know, not who cares, but, you know, obviously everyone here is from elsewhere. But, you know, we have a kind of like a culture that's future oriented. And, you know, if you want to go far back, the founding fathers are like, you know, less than 250 years ago. Right. It's just like it's not a deep time depth. Whereas, like, if you talk to people from, you know, Denmark or Poland, you know, yeah, they're not going back to Mesopotamia times, but they are going back more than 1,000 years ago. And they're kind of like, they're starting to like edge into this period of like late Indo-European Iron Age. And so they take a lot of interest. You know, the recent work on the origin of the Germanic people got a lot of feedback, and there's still more work that's going to come out on that, I think. And so we'll see. I know what the political relevance is, but I noticed that the Slavic, you know, like people in Poland and stuff were definitely paying attention because they want to know, you know.
Particularly the Polish-German border could be, it's always.
You said it, you know, in terms of like who was here first and all these. And actually, like, I don't know all of those, like, arguments, but there's always like there's a lot of arguments like that you kind of like step on as a landmine when you say something casually, because a lot of the things, like if you read the ancient DNA stuff, people are just like, oh, well, we think this is like what's true, but it's not like you're 100% sure. But it turns out you just stepped in a landmine, and you get all these emails, and they're like, you know, we have this border and we were here, like, I don't know about any of this, you know, but they're like, we learned about it in elementary school. So anyways, it's interesting times. We still have a lot of open questions, as I, you know, said to you 3 years ago. I think, though, there has been more advancement. I will say, you know, you emphasize sampling and how important sampling is. And people often ask me, why do geneticists change their opinions so much with, like, you know, these population clusters and they're changing? That's based on, you know, what we call training data, right? And the training data are the samples we have. So yeah. if you don't have a sample, you can't say you come from that population. They didn't know about it. It looks for the closest population. So as our training data gets denser and denser, we will converge onto a true set of the distribution of genetic variation. But until then, in a lot of parts of the world, it's going to be very patchy as our training data is insufficient. So the issue is not the methods of the science, because people are always like, oh, is this like a shady science? I'm like, no, it's not shady at all. It's just the methods are limited by the input data. And as we increase the input data, we will converge on more and more robust, replicated results. Now, whether those results are true is a separate question. But the results can be replicated, and they're going to start to converge on, okay, this is what the genetics says. Now, is that the truth? Again, you have to bring archaeology and linguistics to adjudicate these sorts of things. But there will be a point where genetics starts converging and not moving around all the time. Because right now, people feel a little jerked around when you were leading to Southern Arc paper. And even though Yosef Lazaridis has totally changed his view, he hasn't updated everything. Obviously, this new paper that he has with all these Volga samples did change a lot of things. And that's because, well, he had a lot of new samples. You know, when you have a lot of new data from a new area, you're going to change your results. You're going to change your understanding, your interpretive framework. It's not magic. It's just the way science works. I just think that, you know, when people see these precise estimates, they kind of misunderstand how patchy the upstream input data is. But the methods themselves are pretty robust. So I think I would end with that. Is there anything you want to close out with, Dr. Mallory?
Nope. That's it.
All right. Well, it was a great conversation. I really appreciate having your opinion. And, you know, I hope the quest for the homeland of the Indo-Europeans keeps proceeding onward at the pace of a chariot. I don't know. I had to use something. Anyway, it was great talking to you.
Okay. If you have a sibling with autism, your future child's risk for an autism diagnosis is increased by a factor of 2 to 3.5. ORCID's whole genome embryo reports can help mitigate your child's risk by screening for over 200 genetic variants definitively linked to autism and other neurodevelopmental disorders. Discuss your situation with a genetics expert.
This podcast for kids.
Yes.